The fifth kind.
Humanoid, reptilian, who knows, possibly Anunnaki, from creatures, small, look like little dinosaurs or little, you know, reptilian type of creatures, to very large creatures with huge teeth and huge body parts. And right now, we cannot ask for a better time to contemplate and look inwards and contemplate our lives and what's actually going on. Do we want to go back to this broken world, a broken society that's a dog-eat-dog, where we have to work like slaves just to survive? Then there's an education system that's just fallen apart, that is shoving crap down our children's brains and throats, just indoctrination to create a future obedient labor force for the royal banking elite. And people are very rapidly waking up to them.
If you would like to hear Michael Tellinger go deeper into these and more controversial topics, go to fifthkind.tv for uncensored access to the full 2 hours of this revealing interview.
Welcome to the Fifth Kind TV. Today we are in conversation with Michael Tellinger. Michael is an investigative researcher and founder of the Global Ubuntu Liberation Movement. His research exposes us to compelling new evidence of previous civilizations on planet Earth, and his findings challenge our very understanding of human origins. Michael's books include Slave Species of God, Adam's Calendar, Temples of the African Gods, African Temples of the Anunnaki, The Lost Technologies of the Gold Mines of Enki, and Ubuntu, Contributionism, a Blueprint for Human Prosperity. Michael, welcome to the Fifth Kind TV.
Hi, Paul. Lovely to be with you.
I am really looking forward to getting into conversation with you today. I find it fascinating how your research joins the dots between our hidden and prehistoric past and has led you not only to think differently to the mainstream, but to live differently and to show how that might be done. And you've done that with such courage in the last couple of decades. You give courage to others, myself included. So I really wanted to thank you and acknowledge you for that right at the outset. I'd love to begin in our conversation today. We're going to range across a number of subjects, but I want to begin with you in South Africa, because one of your great contributions to world research has been with regard to a network of stone circles that transgress the borders of a number of countries in southern Africa. Conventional wisdom tells us they're just the remnants of some prehistoric farming community. Your research has demonstrated otherwise. And I wondered if we could start off by you telling us how you discovered these stone circles and what it is that you've discovered.
Well, thanks very much, Paul. The stone circles are really just a name that has stuck when I started to research them. But the first awareness of these stone circle ruins go back 500 years. Strangely enough, that's when the Portuguese first realized, as they came past the Cape of Good Hope from Europe towards India, when they came on land from the Indian Ocean side especially, they came across a lot of these ancient ruins. And even when they got to Great Zimbabwe in those days already, they asked the locals, you know, who built these structures. And they were told unequivocally by the local tribes that they met that they didn't build them. They're just occupying them, and they didn't know who built them. And that's a variation that goes back 500 years. So whatever we read in modern history books about the origins of these stone circles, and it is very different from what I've just told you. Our modern historians tend to think that they know where these structures come from, who built them, when they were built, why they were built, and so forth. And they ascribe them to various tribes. And that's just all absolute nonsense, because we know that that is not the case from 500 years ago already. What I've discovered when I first became aware of these ruins in 2005 or 2004, while I was writing Slave Species of God, I suddenly discovered that South Africa has got this plethora of ancient ruins that nobody knows about. And that just blew my mind. I couldn't believe that nobody's talking about it. This is, you know, this is my country. We all go out to Egypt and all over the world to look at all these ruins. And yet right under our feet, we have this large number of ruins. And when I say large number, at the time when I discovered these ruins, there was an estimate of about 20,000 of these ruins in South Africa. Now, that blew my mind, because 20,000 is a big number already. But little did I know what the discovery would lead to, that is a much bigger number than that. But at the time in 2004, when I first found these papers, and it was not easy to find these papers and the documentation on these ruins. They were written, you know, and they were hidden away in some museum and some archives somewhere. So eventually I got a hold of those papers and read this and just couldn't believe that nobody is aware of it. Nobody's talking about it. There's no photographic evidence anywhere. It was literally like a closed book. The only thing that they spoke about was Great Zimbabwe, and that's pretty much it.
So had they deliberately not studied?
Well, it was studied. It was studied, and a number of expeditions and explorations and research studies were done, excavations, some very basic surface level stuff, not in depth and not detailed and not scientific. And I really need to draw a distinction here. Quite frankly, archaeologists should never, ever be put into the field of science. Although I'm breaking my own laws or whatever, my own definition of what the word science means. I often use that to give people confidence that even if you're a good baker, it means you're actually a scientist. If you're very good at something, very, very good at something, it means you're a scientist in that specific thing. Because science originally comes from the word knowledge, right? So if you're a scientist, you're knowledgeable about a specific subject. But unfortunately, our archaeologists are not scientists in the popular sense of the word. They undertake training, and in that training are very few scientific principles that they apply in what would be deemed as mainstream scientific approach. So when you look at the archaeological studies that have been done, they are very interesting, and they do raise, and I must give them credit, that they do raise, and they did raise, some of the flags, the red flags that attracted me and made me pay attention to the anomalies and the problems that we have with the ancient ruins of South Africa.
So for people who are not familiar with them, can you describe these stone circles to us and why it is that it's clear that they're not the vestige of a farming community?
Right. So the stone circles are circular structures. The walls are made of smaller stones that range from about 10 kilograms to about 200 kilograms. And they they form these circular structures with very strange and irregular internal structures. The main thing that was noted in 1939 probably up to that point, and even since then, I think that was the biggest archaeological exploration and research effort that was made into exploring the stone circles. And that happened just down the road from me at some of these ancient ruins here. And they concluded, and they have drawings of these from 1939, drawings of these stone circles that cover all the mountains. Not all of them, just a few in the area that they studied, but the stone circles go much further than that. And they have drawings of them, and you can see in the drawings very clearly that some of the drawings have no doors and entrances, and some of them do have entrances in some of the walls. And that is critical, because in that 1939 report, which is it's about a 40-page report, they make it very clear that the original structures have no doors and entrances. And that is a very important consideration, because that immediately excludes the fact that these structures were built by people as dwellings, or dwellings for people or cows or other animals. Because if you're not going to put doors or entrances in them, then clearly it's not meant to be a habitational place. And that became a very important shift in my thinking about these structures, and a consistent it's a consistency that you find with all the ancient stone circles, the original ones, and we find many of those that are still covered by soil and sand. Some of them have been exposed and poorly exposed, and then some of them have been completely exposed, and you can still see the original walls as they were built with no doors and entrances. It's like a closed loop. It's spectacular. And that's when we started to measure the weird anomalies with special electronic equipment. But I think you wanted to say something?
Yes, I want to come to the anomalous properties of these circles a little bit later and what the function of them might have been. I just wanted to clarify how enormous this network is, because it overflows the boundaries of a couple of countries, doesn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's unquestionably the largest cluster or concentration, and I call cluster, of ancient ruins anywhere on Earth. It covers probably one third of South Africa, and pretty much most of Zimbabwe. It spills over to, if you're looking at the map, it spills over to the west of us, northwest of us, to Botswana, and to the east of us into Mozambique, and then all the way through Zimbabwe, north across the Zambezi River into Zambia, and Tanzania, and it's just huge. I'm not sure where it ends. It's quite. I wouldn't be surprised if originally this went all the way up the Nilotic Meridian, all the way up to Egypt. That actually would not surprise me, and I've never said this before. It's the first time that I'm actually making this kind of insane statement or an idea, but I would not be surprised if you followed this and you're able to remove the bushes and the trees and the vegetation, you'd probably find that these circles go all the way up to Egypt.
And simply the scale of it suggests that we're looking at something that is the vestige of a civilization. It's not just one like a local city that's built something. There is a knowledge base and a technology and a culture that was enormous, produced what we're looking at now. And that's a point of intrigue right away. I wanted to ask how it relates to Adam's calendar, and if you could tell us a little bit about what Adam's calendar is, how it relates.
Adam's calendar is pretty much the flagship of all these ancient ruins. Adam's calendar is a working sun calendar. It's now recognized as the oldest working sun calendar on Earth. Originally the structure was circular. It's probably about 20 meters across, about 20 meters across, and a circular structure originally, but it's so broken that it's difficult to see it. But if you look on Google Earth, you can still see the circular nature and the original structure of it. And at the center of it are these two stones that face each other. And these two stones are literally like electromagnetic plates. Okay, now they vibrate, they give off energies and frequencies and electromagnetic fields and magnetic fields. And so Adam's calendar is much more than just a sun calendar, but it is structured to actually be a sun calendar, so you can see the passage of the year as the sun sets every day. You can see the sun move from the summer solstice here. So there's two stones. This stone casts a shadow on this stone. If the sun sets on this side, it casts a shadow on this stone. And on this edge, if the shadow is on this edge, that's, you've reached the summer solstice. And then the shadow starts to move as the sun moves back towards winter. The shadow, you can tell the day of the year and the time of the year by where the shadow is as the sun sets. And then the shadow moves across from the one edge to the other edge. And when it reaches the other edge, you've reached the winter solstice. And then it stops and it comes back. So this is a spectacular achievement, and I'm not sure why they did this, why they built this, but because the sun calendar aspect of it is just a built-in feature. It is not the main reason why the calendar exists, because the calendar itself is actually a very powerful machine, energy-generating machine, and I don't know if you want to talk about it now, but just preempting this, because it's a very powerful machine. It's a toroidal toroidal energy generating device that is just so powerful, it boggles the mind. And I say this because I know this, because we've measured it. I don't imagine it is. I know it is.
Yes. I will. Cultural questions around it, though, because straight away that orientation connects it with megalithic structures all around the world that are oriented for solstices, around the movements of the stars. And it's just curious that this these previous civilizations that we don't know much about all had that in common. You about Mesopotamian narratives that talk about the Anunnaki, who we believe were ancient ET colonizers. How does that relate to what we're looking at here? Because there's a connection possibly between the technology this represents and ancient gold mining. How does all this fit together? It sounds like a cocktail.
Yeah, it is all one connected body of information and body of activity. The circles, the stone circles and Adam's calendar are unquestionably the making of the Anunnaki or the Anunna gods, as they are referred to in the Sumerian texts, in thousands and thousands of clay tablets. It's not something that you find in one or two clay tablets, as some people still might think. The Anunna gods are the central figures, the central characters in pretty much most of the Sumerian writing. And most of the Sumerian clay tablets, there's always a reference to the Anunna and the Anunnaki and how they controlled humanity and obviously how they created humanity. And it's all connected to ancient gold mining and the generation of energy, gold mining, and the obsession with gold that the Anunnaki had that we seem to have inherited, this obsession with gold. And that's a very important connection to be made, that humanity's obsession. Why do we use gold as human beings? It has very little purpose to us other than in technology, but that only came very recently. But in ancient times, it was just like this very valuable piece of shiny metal that very few people had access to, and the kings and the lords always hogged it and took it from everybody. And it always belonged to the gods. Whenever you go back in ancient times, and the Europeans arrived while they were colonizing the world in the late 1400s and early 1500s. Wherever the Europeans arrived and they found ancient civilizations and local tribes with huge amounts of gold, pretty much all over the world, the ancient tribes had gold when the Europeans arrived there. This is a spectacular thing. And when they asked them, who does the gold belong to? The answer was always, the gold belongs to the gods. And that was a feeble excuse, strangely enough, that the Spaniards used. Well, if the gold isn't yours, we're just going to take it. And they did.
And, of course, the Spanish had gone looking for it. In South Africa, there is evidence that's been found of prehistoric gold mining. When I say prehistoric, what kind of dates are we looking at for those evidences, and how does that relate to the dating of the stone circles? Because you've done some really cutting edge research into how to date the circle. I wonder if you could tie those things together for us.
Well, the oldest official mine on Earth is just down the road from us, an hour and a half. It's actually just across the border in Swaziland. But obviously when that mine was created, there were no borders here. So we go there quite often on the tours that I do, the sacred sites tours and the journeys that we take throughout Southern Africa and all these amazing places. It's called the Ngwenya Mine. And that mine is officially dated by mainstream archaeology. So you can imagine these guys are really pushed to the limit of their, I think, capacity of allowing this mainstream archaeology to go this far back. It's dated officially 1,000 years. They were mining specularite, they were mining gold, and they were mining some other minerals there as well. That's the big question. And but unfortunately for current archaeology, the guy that discovered that mine, Peter Beaumont, South African archaeologist who's since died, he was probably one of the very few out-of-the-box thinkers and slightly more spiritually connected, because he's the guy that started to understand the Bushman rock art, the Bushman paintings, and how the Bushman shamans would go into trances and connect to the spirit world and so forth. Not all archaeologists are wired that way. And when Peter Beaumont first discovered that, it's called the Lion Cavern. It's a small little mine. It's a tiny little hole, really, in the side of a mountain where they were mining the specularite. But there he discovered under layers of sediment that he believed was more than 100,000 years old. So he originally said that this mine was more than 100,000 years old, but that was not ever published. But you do read it, and it is available in some of the interviews that he did with the media about it. But it was not what was originally put out as the age of the mine. And it just shows you how they manipulate and interfere with the archaeologists' findings and evidence. Yeah. They just change it.
Indeed. That throws a spanner into the works immediately for our conventional timeline for Homo sapiens. We were only supposed to have been this smart for about 10,000 years. So that date, 100,000 years ago, is an anomaly. And the work you've done on the you've dated the stone circles by analyzing the patinas, haven't you? The cuts that have been made in situ. Where did that lead you?
Yeah, look, the stone circles are any time you work with stone, it's very difficult to determine the age because, you know, stone doesn't really age. They do claim that they have some radioactive dating processes and techniques, but it's all just hocus pocus stuff. It's like, you know, take a stone from this mountain here, you take it over there, and you manipulate it, you use it, you carve it, or you do something to it, and things change. So the magnetic alignments change and so forth. So it's very difficult to date stone when you're dealing with stone ruins unless you have organic matter that is somehow connected, inextricably connected to the ruins that you can date. But that becomes a problem because carbon dating is now a problem, and so it's just you have to start using as many deductive considerations as you possibly can. You have to look at everything through the finest little microscope to try and analyze what's going on. Are there any indicators or clues that suggest the age of this? And that's pretty much what I've been doing for 13 years now among the stone ruins and Adams Calendar and South Africa and Zimbabwe. And what I can tell you is that I keep pushing the date further and further back. When we first discovered Adams Calendar, or when Johann Heine accidentally rediscovered Adams Calendar in 2004, and he was trying to share that information with the South African Archaeological Society and so forth, the universities, nobody was paying attention. Nobody even wanted to give him the time of day to come and look at it. They just assumed he was nuts, and that's a huge disgrace. And it just shows you the kind of character that we're dealing with here with these academic institutions. It is a disgrace, and they should be ashamed of themselves. Then he met me, and everything changed. And so I started to spread the information about this. It's very obvious. It's built very consciously. Like you mentioned, it's aligned to all the cardinal points, north, south, east, west. It's got solstices, equinoxes, alignments. It's got the calendar itself that works absolutely perfectly from solstice to solstice. And when we first discovered this, the one weird thing that there were two very strange things about Adam's calendar is that it aligns with the rise of Orion on the eastern side of the rise of Orion in the east. And that's where we have the fallen stone, which I call the Horus stone. It's a beautifully carved shaped stone, a nice fat belly, and then a nice neck like a Horus bird. It looks exactly like a Horus bird. And if you lift it up in a position that it fell, next to it are three other stones. One of those three stones is beautifully carved into a shape like a very sharp point. The others are broken and they're less impressive. But if you lift them up, it looks like Horus is looking directly at these three stones, and those stones line up with the rise of Orion in the east at certain times of the year. And this is not a coincidence, you know. So now we have a repetition of the Horus looking at Orion, which Osiris, Orion, Osiris, there's a connection there, and it's connected to Egypt immediately. Not only do we have this connection to Egypt now, where we have Horus and Orion and Osiris, but we also have Adam's calendar, Great Zimbabwe, and the Great Pyramid of Giza, all connected on the 31 degrees east longitudinal line, or what's often called the Nilotic Meridian. So there's an incredible connection between Adam's calendar, Great Zimbabwe, and the Great Pyramid of Giza. And what have they all got to have in common? Ancient gold mines and ancient mining civilizations, gold mining civilizations. And people often forget that Egypt was a gold mining civilization.
And the other
amazing thing, though, Paul, is that when we did an analysis, a land survey of the site, the north, south, east, west alignments are out by 3.25 degrees anti-clockwise, and that is just unacceptable, because these guys were so advanced, they would not have made a mistake. So the only conclusion I can reach from that is that whoever built it, it looks like the Anunnaki were the architects, for other reasons that we can go into, just mind-blowing reasons. And when they built it, the orientation of the world and the true north-south alignment was different from where it is today. Because this is not magnetic north that we're measuring. We're measuring true north, the North Pole, the true north. And that is impossible, because the axis of the Earth, as far as we know, hasn't shifted. Or is there an axis? So it brings up a whole bunch of questions and huge question marks. Because when Adam's calendar was built, north-south alignment was not where it is today.
Now, your research has picked up on some really interesting properties that these structures have, things to do with temperature, sonic properties, that suggest that what we're actually looking at is some kind of an energy grid. Can you tell us a bit more about that and how that relates to mining and its role in this prehistoric civilization?
Yes, the stone circles themselves are very interesting in structure and shape. And why is every stone circle completely unique? There are no two stone circles that are the same. And that boggled my mind right in the beginning. So in late 2007, early 2008, I started to pick up and collect these elongated stones. I started to call them stones that ring like bells. And you can go on YouTube and watch me ring some of these stones. And they literally, if you close your eyes, it sounds like metal, not like a stone. And it always catches people by surprise. So I started to collect these strange tools and artifacts I was picking up everywhere, these elongated stones. And those are normally the ones that ring so beautifully. But I couldn't make any sense of it. Why are these stones these weird shapes? And I couldn't understand why, but I just knew that they rang beautifully. And then I discovered that the stones in the stone walls of the stone circles themselves also have acoustic properties. They all ring like bells. And coming from a musical background and studying sound and understanding sound, cymatics, the shape of sound, and cymatics is the term for the study of sound manifesting into physical form, right? Mm-hmm. Like the primordial source code of creation. That's what sound really is. And when I realized that the stone circle, that the stones ring like bells, and we started to measure sound frequencies and electromagnetic fields coming out of the stone circles, coming out of the walls of the stone circles, very high sound frequencies from about 14 gigahertz, right? This is not something to be scoffed at. This is just incredible. From, I think, 11 gigahertz all the way up to Adam's calendar, beyond 375 gigahertz of sound frequency that these things generate. It's unheard of in nature. And then the electromagnetic fields that range from... Go ahead.
At certain pitches, that would be what, the volume of a jet taking off?
Oh my God! Anything in gigahertz is just very, very powerful. It's like modern day cell phone towers. So we're not dealing with low tech here. We're dealing with very high tech. And then the electromagnetic fields that we started to measure in there of, you know, up to 400, I think the highest we measured in the stud circles was 480 megahertz. And then at Adam's calendar, it went up to like 2000 megahertz. And it varies every time we go back and measure it with different equipment, because I don't always have the same equipment. I just don't have the funds. So I have to rely on people, and they come and arrive here and they have special equipment. We go and do the measurements, we record it, and then they go away. And then, you know, until somebody else arrives with slightly different equipment. But what we've discovered is that the frequencies emitted by the stone circles keep changing. What tells me is that the stone circles are alive. They're not static. They are working still today. But the most important thing about this is that once I realized that the stone circles give off these energies, these frequencies, it suddenly made sense why they are built like that and the shapes that they take on. Because it suddenly became very obvious that every stone circle is just a representation of the sound front of the ground at that specific point. So the stone circle itself takes on a cymatic shape or a cymatic pattern of that sound frequency at that specific point. And because the surface of the earth is not even, then you've got different sands and stones and quartz densities and so forth under this in the soil underneath it. The sound, the primordial sound frequencies of the earth rings like a bell all the time. It never stops ringing. And these frequencies make their way to the surface of the earth. And there, these guys knew exactly how to tap into those frequencies coming out of the earth, the soil, and they built the stone walls along the cymatic pattern of that particular area. And by doing that, they capture the sound frequencies coming out of the earth. That sound then goes into the walls of the stone circle. The sound moves around the walls and it amplifies itself, because that's what it does, because it's in a sacred geometric pattern. So it amplifies itself. And that moving sound then creates magnetic fields, and moving magnetic fields create electromagnetic fields. And what I've just described to you there is literally describing the fundamental basics understanding of the manifestation of something out of nothing. Or as we read in the first passage of the Bible, that God said, "Let there be light." There was nothing, and the Spirit of God moved over the waters, and then God said, "There be light." That's what these guys were doing. They were turning sound, like the word of God, word of the Creator, they were turning sound into very powerful energy machines. And now on top of that, it's not just one machine, not just one stone circle. We're dealing with more than 10 million of these stone circles. So we're looking at an incredibly vast, huge energy-generating machine that covers more than two countries in Southern Africa, generating unimaginable amount of energy. The question, where they're using the energy for?
That's the question. I mean, it's a phenomenally sophisticated technology. It represents a very advanced civilization to know how to tap that. What were they using it for?
Well, at this stage, there are a number of theories. And again, you know, my theories change based on the evidence that I have. And again, I'm not sure if I mentioned it already. Short-term memory loss here. I like to say that I do what the guys in CSI do. I follow the clues and the evidence. And I base my conclusions on the clues and the evidence that I have. And that's what it is. Until tomorrow or next week, when I find new evidence and new clues, then I change my perspective and my views on what I thought before. So what I know today and what I think today is vastly different from what I thought 10 years ago. And that's how everybody should work with when you work in the field of discovery. You can't get stuck on a theory or idea that's 10 years old or 20 years old, or in some instances, 100 years old, like the atomic model, for example, that they still teach us in physics. It's just a spectacular disservice to all of humanity. They're still teaching the same bogus BS atomic model in physics at school and at university. And this is why they can't make heads or tails of the nature of reality and how things work. But I'm digressing now. So you've got to move with the flow and the new discoveries to make more sense of things. So it's a very sophisticated, as you say, a very high advanced knowledge of the use of sound and resonance and how to convert sound and resonance into a useful tool and technology for pretty much everything they did. So originally I thought that all these stone circles were generating energy for the gold mining that they were doing. And I'm still on that thought. It's obviously the first thing that comes to mind because there was such a large scale gold mining going on here. It boggles the mind. I probably can't even imagine how big it is. And my imagination of that is much bigger than most other people at this stage. But these Anunnaki were mining the earth. They were mining such vast areas of the earth for gold. We can't imagine it because in our perspective, in our perception, there's not enough money to set up all these gold mines because, you know, we use money. And if we don't have enough money, we won't be able to set up the gold mines. Well, they didn't have money. They didn't use money. They just did stuff and they did it because that's what they did for their civilization and their species to thrive. So gold mining, absolutely. Energy for the gold mines, absolutely. No question about that. But there is another twist here because this is such a vast engineering undertaking. We could never construct anything like this today. In the world today, with all the engineers, all the architects, we couldn't do this because, first of all, we don't have the technology. We don't know where to put the stone circles and how to tap into those frequencies of the earth. Well, I guess there are people that would be able to do that, but they're certainly not in the mainstream. And so this is such a vast undertaking with more than 10 million of these structures all connected to each other with these channels. And all those stone circles that are connected to each other, they then sit in what I call the spider's web. And the spider's web is really just a network of terraces, agricultural terraces that from the air look like spider's webs that hold the stone circles connected to each other by these channels. It's an integrated network that covers an entire southern African continent. It's an unimaginable architectural and construction feat and achievement. So they must have done this for some very, very serious reasons, because this is a very serious construction. So I'm beginning to think, and I have been thinking for the past few years now, that the original idea must have been a little bit more than just, and I'm beginning to see evidence that they may have used the energy generated by the stone circles to actually manipulate the atmosphere, manipulate the climate, geoengineering, manipulating the climate and possibly creating a climate that was conducive for their stay and for doing the work that they were doing. It's looking more and more like that the stone circles are actually a very, very large geoengineering, terraforming, climate control machine.
So they're there to create a certain climate that supports everything they were doing. Does that relate in some way to the role of the Abzu in the Sumerian narrative?
Are you talking about the Abzu?
Yes.
Yes. So the Abzu is a well-recognized term in the Sumerian texts for this place that is, there's quite a bit of controversy about it and an argument about what the Abzu is or where was it or what is it. But there are enough references to the Abzu being where the gold came from for me to assume that the Abzu is the place where they were mining gold. And then they differentiate between the Abzu and then the deep Abzu, which I've come to understand as being Zimbabwe, which is closer to Mesopotamia, where the Anunnaki were settled. And so Zimbabwe was the Abzu, and then the deep Abzu was further away, further south, which was probably most likely the reference to South Africa, which it would be today. So we have the Abzu and the deep Abzu that is often referenced in the Sumerian text, and that is where the gold came from. And so the largest gold operations were set up by the Sumerian supreme entity or being called Enki, deity. He was in charge of all the gold mining. He was in charge of all the activity. He was the supreme Anunnaki dude on Earth and one of the supreme Anunnakis everywhere. And he pretty much ruled the roost. There's been some confusion about, you know, his so-called brother or Enlil, and we can go into that if you want to later. But Enki was the guy that was running the mining, the mining construction, and he was also the guy that was then tasked when the Anunnaki couldn't handle all the mining activity. They just didn't want to do the mining and the hard work anymore. That's when they decided to clone a new species, and suddenly humanity makes its appearance. Humanoid, reptilian, who knows, possibly Anunnaki. Now, I'm saying this is a finger. This is a finger of a giant, right? It's about 50 times, about 50 of my fingers will probably fit in there. It's a rough estimate. So this is 50 times larger than I am. So we're looking at about an 80 meter tall being. And right now, we cannot ask for a better time to contemplate and look inwards and contemplate our lives and what's actually going on. Do we want to go back to this broken world, a broken society that's a dog-eat-dog, where we have to work like slaves just to survive? Then there's the education system that's just fallen apart, that is shoving crap down our children's brains and throats, just indoctrination to create a future obedient labor force for the royal banking elite. And people are very rapidly waking up to this.
If you would like to hear Michael Tellinger go deeper into these and more controversial topics, go to fifthkind.tv for uncensored access to the full 2 hours of this revealing interview.